Welcome back to the podcast. My guest today is Turner Rowland. He's the host of the Turner Rowland podcast. Thanks for being on here, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jeff. And you're down in Colorado, aren't you?
I'm in Laramie, Wyoming. Yeah. My wife is finishing up her PhD, so I'm taking a month-long break, or we're taking a month-long break from Alaska to be down here and look for smaller fish.
All right. Well, is it as smoky as it is in Bozeman down there?
It's actually not. A couple days ago, we couldn't really see the snowies from Laramie, but I think the wind direction has kind of shifted, so I think it's all blowing that way, which is good. I mean, not that there's fires, but we're headed to Yellowstone in a couple days, so hopefully the smoke won't be hanging out in there because you kind of like to enjoy it.
Yeah, right. I mean, I know it's bad. I know it's really bad in the Tetons right now, but here at Bozeman, it's kind of been blowing in and out. Yesterday was really clear, and then today it just kind of rolled back in again. So I know there's some fires over by Billings, and there's even one about 30 minutes away in Three Forks, and just kind of disappointing how hot it's been, man, and how dry it's been. But you can see the impact in the rivers and how long runoff lasted and everything like that. But hopefully it'll clear up soon, and maybe we'll get some snow in September or something and calm everything down a little bit.
Yeah. It seems like there's fires all the time. Is this like because we're hearing about every single fire, or is it kind of like this?
This is an especially bad year from what I've seen. Usually, fire season is like late July into September. But I mean, fires are starting up like early June, man, when snow's still supposed to be in the mountains, and runoff lasted only 3 weeks, and typically the Yellowstone will be chocolate mud and real high from about probably mid-April to maybe the 4th of July on some years. And it was clear, I think first week of June, it was fishable. So wow. it's been an odd year. But do you guys not have fires up in Alaska as much?
We do. I live in southeast Alaska, and it's just always wet there, so we really don't have many fires. But in the interior, it gets pretty dry, and I think there are some fires that are burning up there right now, but it's so inaccessible that they just kind of burn and then burn out. And you just don't, I mean, you have some big ones up there, but it just doesn't get nearly the attention as some of these areas down here. It can be covered more, and it overlaps with where people live a lot more. So we have some of that stuff, but you just get these numbers of acreages, and you just hear so much about it. When I was coming down here to hunt mule deer last October, I think it was the Mullen Fire was the one here in the Snowy Range. And like a week before, there was some snow and some rain, and so it kind of, tempered it out. But the one that was down in Colorado, that massive one, was full going. And I'm just thinking, man, this is October. It's cold and rainy in Alaska, yeah. But man, I'm coming down here and there's snow, or there's snow on some peaks, but just fire everywhere. It's just crazy.
Yeah, I was hunting a mountain range in southwest Montana, and we watched a fire start just from a little fleck of smoke when we started to a really big smokestack when we ended the day, and airplanes coming in and helicopters coming in. It was kind of interesting what you said about if it's just the fire season or if it's kind of getting more attention. And right before I hopped on, I read a little thing about Yellowstone, and they've seen like 1 million visitors just in the month of June, which typically they see about 500,000. So it's almost a double increase. And it's kind of unfortunate because, it's a double-edged sword having so many visitors in the park, because, number one, everybody gets to experience it. And it's a magical place. And will it be your first time heading to the park?
No, I've been there three times. Once when I was really young, and then a couple of years ago, a buddy and I flew down to California, and we drove out to we stayed at Lake Hebgen outside of Yellowstone, and we went into the park a little bit to see some of the stuff. So it'll be the second fly fishing trip.
Oh, great. So you know exactly what I'm talking about, how special of a place it is. And it's kind of a double-edged sword because a lot of people come out here and you want to experience, you want them to experience the best parts of it. But it's hard to when there's, a million people in 1 month. And then on top of that, you got the smoke and the fires and the bad air quality. And it's just like, man, when is Montana going to get a little break?
Yeah, the tourism thing is being in Southeast Alaska, we're so dependent upon tourism and the cruise ships. And because the logging has kind of gone out, it's a fraction of what it was. Ketchikan kind of had to reinvent itself. So in the 90s, it went from a logging community and fishing community to full tilt tourism and fishing. And so just so much more pressure to get to good spots to fish and then cruise ships. And last year we were expecting over 1 million visitors off cruise ships in Ketchikan, but then zero showed up because of COVID. And so you just see how dependent upon tourism and how you need to have those people. But at the same time, you'd become at the mercy of it. Like what else is, going to bring in that revenue? You have to have those people that are showing up, but then it makes it crowded. You think, oh my gosh, all these tourists, all these cruise ships and all these extra people that are fishing where I want to fish. And man, I wish these people just weren't there. But then without them, you have nothing. So it really is. And with more and more people, like you can have this, and I've been thinking about this a lot. I think I mentioned in my previous podcast that we have enough people now to where we can have this idea that more people than ever are staying at home and that are staying on their computers and that are nature deprived, and yet still have this feeling of overcrowding in the woods. Like there's so much people to sustain both stereotypes. It's crazy.
It really is. And you've seen that in Bozeman. And I don't know what specifically has sparked the change in people moving here. I mean, obviously COVID, but the secret's out on a lot of these places. I remember last year going to Cliff and Wade Lake, which I used to keep a secret because it's so awesome. And it's basically, I explain it like the Bahamas in the mountains. And it's got, emerald, or I guess turquoise water, blue water, almost like glacier belt. And it's actually where the former Montana state record brown trout was caught. So they're a big fish and it's really pretty. And before, I've never seen a soul up there. And then a magazine article got written on it this past year, and I couldn't find a place to park my trailer. And it was just so strange. And can you hear me, Jeff?
Yeah, it was weird. It just kind of dropped. I don't know. I think we're good. So you were
All
talking
right.
about places being ruined by people talking about them in Bozeman.
Well, I'm very careful what I say on this subject because I want nothing more than for people to experience the outdoors like I have. And I consider myself very fortunate and lucky to have the experiences that I've had. But at the same time, I think there needs to be some sort of education. Like, I think you need to pass a quiz before you need to go into Yellowstone, And as you've been there several times, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, approaching bison, going off trail. And usually that's not a problem in say, a national forest if you go off trail. But, in a national park, one person goes off trail in a popular place, creates a little path, and then, 200 people do it. And it kind of degrades the resource in a little bit. So I'm not saying at all that I don't think people should experience these. I'm saying they should experience them in a respectful and a responsible manner, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a big difference between laws, rules, and then like ethics. If it's clear that this
Very
is
true.
against the law or you don't do this, there's a rule against it, but then there's the ethical sort of code of visiting somewhere. And I think, as you and I are voices in the outdoor realm, like we're creating content, so there's always the opportunity for us to, because we don't live there, we might go somewhere else and talk about something or write about something or broadcast something that someone doesn't necessarily want to get out. And so I think that's an important ethical thing for us to say, you know what, I maybe I talk about a lake, maybe I don't name it, I know I could get a lot of people, you know, to read the article. I can get a lot of clicks and hits and listens if I tell people specific things. And it's kind of the DIY. Here's what you do. But, you know, that's someone else's backyard. That's someone else's honey hole that they worked to find. So I think that's kind of an ethical dilemma. But, you know, ethics can't be enforced. You know, like, you don't want more laws. And that's kind of one of the things that we do. We complain about people saying things or doing certain things, and we want more regulation, but then we end up just handcuffing ourselves.
Yeah, that's very true. And you know, on that subject, something interesting came about on the legislation side of things, where I believe the Montana governor is trying to outlaw the sale of coordinates of hunting spots. Did you hear about this?
Oh, I haven't, no.
Yeah, so specifically, one example that everyone keeps pointing to is an out-of-state an out-of-state hunter, and I won't name the state because it's easy to rag on him. I'm sure you know who I'm referring to, but an out-of-state hunter came, you know, in Montana and hunted several times and was lucky enough and skillful enough to harvest a few bulls, and for whatever reason he can't hunt there anymore, and he was selling his coordinates to the highest bidder on Craigslist. And this kind of, you know, it's a weird thing. It's you know, technology is amazing, and with technology comes more responsibility and you know, with security especially. I mean, I would be horrified if my Onyx account got hacked. And just for that reason, I have quite a few dummy waypoints just in case. but I mean, it's weird. The line between ethics and law. Do I think it should be law to not be able to sell your coordinates? Not really. I mean, if you're going to do that, then, you know, whatever, maybe you really need the money. I don't know. Do I want you to do that? No, but you know, should it be law? Probably not. I mean, we're in a weird time, Jeff.
Yeah, that's crazy. Do you think this is like the golden age of outdoor content, or is it like the Wild West, or where do you think we're at?
You know, that's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think we continue to see content creators, specifically Ranella, who kind of revolutionized the game, and you have people before him like Remy Warren and his other host with Solo Hunter kind of revolutionizing the outdoor space, and then, you know, before him you have Jim
Shockey,
good night. Yeah, he's one of my heroes. I can't believe I didn't remember his name. But you know, you just have these evolutions of content creators, and it can, the same can be said for the fishing space. Mm-hmm. In a way, we're in the Wild West, especially in the terms of marketing. There are different marketing practices and things that the Meat Eater crew has really dialed in and perfected, and has started acquiring other podcasts and doing marketing the same. And you see the same successful kind of formula form for them. And so in a way it is the Wild West, and you're starting to see specifically in the fishing space people like Monster Mike, who I'm not ragging on him at all, but you know, he's kind of got himself in a tight spot where he obviously feels a need to up himself every time he makes a video, like you know, he's doing backflips when he's setting the hook on a bass, and he's doing all these other crazy things, and he's constantly in a state of trying to figure out how he can make crazier and crazier videos, because that's his niche. That's what he's known for.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, it is the Wild West, and you're seeing a lot of people starting to make a living from it. And, you know, that's the fantastic part of it. But then there's the concerning part of it where, I mean, people who are really good at marketing and don't really know what they're talking about can be successful in it.
Right. Yeah, I think the golden age constitutes or evokes a feeling of like best and quality, whereas Wild West is just kind of like untamed. And I think it does have both. Like you said, people can make a living from it, and they're doing a great job. I think, you know, Randy Newberg was another one of those guys who, and he's such a great guy because he will go and he will testify on behalf of things, and he advocates for hunters. You know, he's not one of those guys who's just in it for him, and that's one of the things I really like about him.
Have you had the pleasure of meeting Uncle Randy?
No, see, I'm just up in Alaska doing the thing. Like, I haven't been to any events or any conventions or anything like that, so I have not met anybody in any realm, because I'm just usually during the summers I'm on Prince of Wales Island just fishing and doing my own thing. So yeah,
well, I'll testify zero. I'll give a shout out to Randy Newberg, because he is by far the kindest person, maybe besides Bill Dance, that I've ever met in the outdoor space. I mean, I remember having a barbecue where from a mutual friend where he was invited, and I was invited, and he would just sit and talk to me for hours, and it was obvious that I had nothing to contribute to the conversation. Then I was just asking questions, and I've met him 3 or 4 times, and every time I just come away feeling like I was, you know, valued as even just a fan. And there's something to be said about that. I mean, the genuineness of the outdoor space is very volatile right now. And he's one of the shining examples of just, I mean, you look at him, I don't have anything bad to say about Randy Newberg. I mean, everything he does, I'm a huge fan of his. Yeah.
There's, like you said, like there's a lot of people who in the outdoor industry, they're just wondering what they can get from you and what's the angle they can play. And it's, I don't know, it's just kind of gross and greasy. And I like that. One of the reasons I love being in, like for this, as I've been an outdoor writer for a while, just writing a column for a newspaper in Alaska and then selling some articles to magazines, just being a high school teacher and just doing the thing in Alaska. And it's been a lot of fun because I haven't had that pressure to, I don't know, be part of it. You know, it's like if you want to be a singer, you go to Nashville. If you want to be in the movies, you go to Hollywood. If you want to be in the outdoor industry, you go to Bozeman. It's like people with those dreams, you know, that go and show up. And I just, yeah, that might be oversimplified. I drove through Bozeman once. I have, you know, I've talked to some people who said that it's awesome, and other people who say like it's just kind of weird. But it's nice to not have to, I don't know, like prove yourself really. You know, my podcast is called The Mediocre Alaskan, so I don't have any sort of facade or any sort of way I have to outdo myself. I can just tell stories, and it's very freeing to be able to just tell my story, and you know, it's not fantastic, and it doesn't have, you know, it's not exploding like some other people, but it's nice to be able to have that authenticity and then to look up to other people and say, you know what, that works. I'm not going to be the next Randy Newberg for sure, but it's just nice to see some of those larger personalities who are genuine, and so it's not, doesn't have this totally fake feel.
Yeah, and I was about to say, man, you're a shining example of that, the Mediocre Alaskan Podcast. And there's certainly a market for people who aren't exactly experts, but, I mean, you know what you're talking about, man. I mean, you know more than most, for sure. And it's great to just see a market of people who want to follow a journey of learning something and getting better at something.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Thank you. One of the reasons why I started it was just to have like an Alaska voice telling the Alaska stories. Like everybody wants to come up to Alaska, and a lot of people do. And, you know, I love hearing their stories. I love watching the content. When Randy has Jim Baichtal on, I remember when Jim Baichtal would come to my science class when I was in 3rd or 4th grade. I was like, oh, Jim Baichtal's coming in to talk to us.
So
you know?
Cool.
And now he's, you know, I was like, wait, he's on Newberg's show? Oh, wait, oh, that's cool. You know, but just so unassuming. And then finding out that Steve Rinella had a cabin on Prince of Wales, just like, wait, what? He's got a cabin here? So, you know, just kind of telling that, here's a podcast from October. You know, here's what it's like in January and February. And I think it's just so nice to not paint yourself in a corner. And I like, you know, there's some other newer podcasts, and I think you have that same sort of tone of just, I'm just going to talk to people I want to talk to and just, you know, see where it goes. And it's kind of nice to not, you don't have to, you know, become something or some character. And I think that's good.
Well, I also think that with how many characters are either in the outdoor space or trying to infiltrate the outdoor space, I think the audiences, they're not as dumb as those people you know, want to make them out. They're not just blind consumers. They can absolutely sort through the bullcrap, and they will gravitate towards people who are authentic. And if that means that you're not an expert, well, power to you. There's a story in that.
Yeah.
And if that means you are an expert, well, there's certainly a story in that. How did you become an expert? You know, what are your recommendations for people who, you know, look up to you? And there's really a place for everybody, it seems. And you know, it certainly doesn't mean that your skill level will determine your popularity at all. Mm-hmm. And even if that's your question, you know, when I started my podcast, it was just about telling stories. I mean, I look at, you know, the people I know, and there are so many incredible stories that would never get told publicly if I didn't start the podcast. And I'm a huge story nerd. I mean, I love to read. I'm always reading something, and I just love stories, and I love telling stories and hearing stories. And that's all I'm about. And I'm not pretending to be some, you know, crazy badass grizzly bear hunter, and, you know, in Alaska. And I just like to do what I do and fish and hunt and you know, tell stories, get to know people. I mean, that's just me. And I try to be as authentic as I can, but sometimes it is hard because you do look at the, you know, Randy Newbergs and the other people that you look up to and think so much about, and you want to be like them so bad. But, you know, sometimes that's not you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, do you see those ads for those master classes?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
There was one, it was Steve Martin, and he said, whatever makes you unique, do it and know there's room for you. And I was like, that's a great, it just speaks that authenticity. You know, and do that. And I think there's going to be a level of correction, because I think there's a lot of people who watch things sarcastically or for the shock factor, but I think there's going to be a bit of a correction maybe. And so it'll be more about substance. I think going forward, people are going to really appreciate more of the substantial type stuff and the authentic type looks going forward. I think there was a massive boom with just content and just stuff out there, but I think people are going to be more diligent maybe in weeding out some of the crazy stuff, but I don't know. I've been wrong before.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's always going to be a place for that, you know, the clickbait, you know, stuff that I won't name specific examples, but I can think, I'm sure you can think three or four off the top of your head too, but I think there will always be a place for that, but I don't think that those characters will last that long in the space. I think it's kind of a revolving door.
Right. Yeah. Do you think that there are things that we as hunters and anglers should be more aware of? Because in addition to kind of making our own names or whatever, contributing to the content thing, there's also a lot of people who are anti-hunter and, you know, want to shut this down. So are there certain things that maybe we should stop saying or stop doing, not to like censor ourselves, but just to acknowledge that there's a growing group of people who don't want us to be able to do this anymore. Like the word trophy.
Man.
I think the word trophy is, we would probably be good to not use that word anymore. Cause every time that we use that, that becomes donations for anti-hunter types. And I think we have to acknowledge the growing amount of people that haven't experienced it and aren't going to be able to experience it, that every time they see that, that's just dollar signs for anti-hunting efforts. Are there some things that we should probably be more careful about going forward?
You know, that's a really great and deep question. And it's something that I've contemplated for quite some time. And, you know, I think I've settled on I don't think that responsibility is up to us, man. I mean, I think that there is some responsibility in terms of being an ethical hunter and an ethical angler and taking out, you know, on the terms of trophy hunting, the old bulls, the bulls who have bred their genes. Mm-hmm. And I think that if the anti-hunters and, you know, this isn't a topic I like to talk too much about it, but let's do some exploring. If the anti-hunters jump to conclusions about trophy hunting, that means they don't understand what trophy hunting is. And actually, trophy hunting is the best management practice because you're taking out the larger, older bulls or bucks that have bred their genes and who are, you know, either pushing off younger bucks from the feedlots or wherever they're feeding, the best grazing grounds, their favorite, and are, you know, allowing them to starve to death if the population isn't being managed properly. I don't know if that responsibility is entirely up to us. And I do know what you're saying about certain terms and for to use woke mentality, trigger words, right? Like trophies. But there has to be some give and take. But on the counter of that, we are kind of at a time where a lot of people don't really agree with hunting, and they're not going to do their research. I think that education is extremely important in this space. And, you know, on the topic of the term trophy hunting, why don't we explain what trophy hunting is? And why don't we explain why it's better to shoot an old buck and a big bull rather than a spike? And why don't we give out this content and explain it in an open and inclusive way rather than just, you know, segregating ourselves to, oh, these are the trophy hunters and these are the people who do it right, when in reality it's kind of the opposite way. Is that making sense at all?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that if you try to appease everybody, you end up not even really being, you know, we just talked about being genuine, right? So if you end up trying to not use certain things and just try to impress everybody, you end up not really being anything. So I think it's really important to be yourself, but I think it's, you know, being conscious of it and knowledgeable and being able to explain it, I think, is a huge thing too. So if someone says, well, why do you trophy hunt? You can have a very calm sort of, this is the exact reason why this is better. And so you are explaining things to them using science and why it's actually better this way, rather than getting in the yelling match or, you know, just, you know, saying more trigger words to kind of antagonize them back. But I think it is important to be conscious of how things can be read, but just ultimately, I can't worry about anybody else, right? I just got to do my thing and whatever my personal ethics are. And however, if I don't want to personally use the word trophy, then that's fine. But I should worry more about myself than what other people are doing.
Right, right. And, you know, I guess what I was really saying is I don't think there's anything wrong with hunting. I love hunting and I grew up on it. It's a, you know, it's a part of who I am, and it's a passion that I have. And it's, I mean, to be frankly honest with you, a lot of times it's not even about the animal. It's just about the connection you have with nature and being out in the woods and spending time with the people that you love.
Yeah.
And a lot of times hunting is just an avenue to that. So from my perspective, I don't think there's anything wrong with hunting. Now, should we do a better job of explaining why there's nothing wrong with hunting? Maybe and probably, but I don't think that we should be walking on eggshells constantly worrying about what these people are thinking, because you see it in social media all the time, where the fewest people speak the loudest. And when I talk to people about hunting, there's not an overwhelming consensus that hunting is bad and hunters are bad people. Now, there are some hunters that are bad people, but the general consensus that I have is that 99% of the people that I run into the woods are very genuine, very nice, very respectful, want to give you your space and truly appreciate, you know, what they're doing and what you're doing. And I mean, it's an interesting topic. And I guess I just don't like walking on eggshells talking about something that I love and care about so much and has such a deep meaning to the type of person that I am.
Yeah. I think COVID really exposed just how important it is to have real meaningful things in your lives. I had students that would go out hunting during COVID and just thought about all those kids who, you know, were locked up somewhere because of the lockdowns, or, you know, like you're doing something so purposeful and meaningful. You're going out with your buddies and you're hunting. You're going out with your parents and hunting. And I know you've hunted and fished with your dad, and that mentorship, that the importance of a present father or mother, like that's such a huge thing. And I think it needs more attention. I think it should absolutely get a ton more attention that, hey, look at this purposeful thing that people are doing together. How important has that been in your development and as a just a you know a conscious, healthy, person who's appreciative and expresses gratitude and wants to do good going forward? How important has hunting with your dad been? Dad been in cultivating that?
Well, it's interesting. My hunting relationship with my dad is relatively new. I grew up in the Florida Keys in Key West, where my dad was a fishing guide for about 15 years, and our relationship has largely been formed on saltwater fishing and specifically flats fishing, sight fishing for hermit tarpon and bonefish. And there are a lot of similarities in the terms of the solitude that you experience on the ocean, the fact that you're actually seeing these fish and casting to them, the fact that you kind of have to be quiet, make sure not to slam any live wells or coolers or anything like that. And similar on the fact that a lot of really good conversations come up when you're in the middle of the ocean or the middle of the woods, not seeing anything, or you are seeing anything and you're having a great day. And it's been extremely fundamental in my relationship with my father, because he would come back from a fishing trip and he would grab me and say, "Hey, Turner, the tarpon are still biting. Let's, we have about 3 hours till sunset. You want to go catch some fish?" And the answer was always a resounding yes. And when we moved up to Tennessee, for educational reasons, because the schools in Key West are not as good as the schools in Tennessee. And when we moved back up, my hunting relationship really started with my grandfather, teaching me how to dove hunt and all the things that a boy likes to do: run in the woods and shoot shotguns and be introduced to the world of wing shooting. And finally, after begging him and begging him to go hunt a deer — he knew nothing about deer hunting. He's never been deer hunting before I came along, and we started that relationship with big game hunting. And I moved out west to pursue elk hunting and mule deer hunting and western duck hunting, turkey hunting, bear hunting. My dad has kind of followed me along that, and he's been fascinated by specifically elk, because I'm not really sure why that attracts him so much. I think it's the communication with the animals. We really liked to turkey hunt. Starting around maybe 7th grade, I think I killed my first turkey with him. And so it's a lot similar in that aspect. But back to your question on how fundamental it's been in our relationship, it's really it's the foundation, man. I mean, it's a passion that we both share. And if you share a passion with your loved ones, that's pretty special, no matter what it is.
Yeah, it's so important to have those connections to people, and then also that sense of purpose. We have such a large portion of our community. Kids don't feel connected to anything. They don't feel that purpose. Like, teen suicide rates are up, and depression is up, and not that hunting solves everything, but I mean, for a kid who, goes out, you go wing shooting, you bring home dove, like, you brought home dinner, like, you accomplished something, like, you served a purpose, like, you have value, and those sort of things are just so important. And then the connection, and it doesn't even have to be with just father, grandfather, just other men or other women in your life, just to connect to the community. It's so important.
It is, and I love that comment that you made on the sense of purpose, because it's purposeful, but it's also — you also, when you hold a gun in your hand, you have a profound amount of responsibility for the people around you and yourself. And to teach a young boy how to handle a gun properly, or a young girl, I think just really helps them understand how, their actions affects others, and how you can learn how to be safe and have, the best time of your life with something that can be incredibly dangerous, and really is incredibly dangerous. But if you handle it in the right way, everything's cool. And then bringing food home to the table and having that sense of fulfillment and purpose and importance as a young man was instrumental, definitely, to the way I think about game and food and nature. Because, you know, I remember my parents had a friend who moved from New York City because their kids didn't understand how a seed could be planted and a tree could grow from the ground. And I think that you got to have that connection as a kid. I mean, that's extremely important, in my opinion.
Yeah. My parents moved up to Alaska when I was 5, and I got the impression that my dad was always a little bit sad or frustrated or felt like he'd kind of failed. Like, we had a really good boat program going on in Nebraska and Colorado, and caught lots of fish. And my dad would whitetail hunt, and they'd pheasant hunt. Mom really liked it. But then, you know, learning Alaska is a totally different thing. And it was always kind of a struggle, and we bought a boat, and it just always broke down. So when I was a little kid, you know, all I remember was coming back in using the kicker because the main went out, and, you know, 4 hour slogs on the ocean to get back into town. So I really hated ocean fishing because I was pretty young and not really patient. My brother was a little bit older. He was a little bit more patient. And I know he caught a 55 pound halibut, and my dad was so happy and he was so proud, but I was, I think, asleep during the whole thing because I was impatient. But just getting through some of that, and I look back and I think, man, that was just so awesome that they're willing to, like, let's go do it. That's some serious outdoor stuff. That's a serious adventure. And I, at the time, it may have felt like he, you know, it just didn't work out the way he had planned. He got a commercial permit for halibut too, and that didn't really work out. It's just kind of a disaster. But man, just learned so much from that, you know, and just that opportunity to get out and just see that real wild. And when I look back at how I felt in high school about, oh, there's nothing here, this town of 700 people, my graduating class of 16, there's just nothing here. But then, man, it was such an amazing place to grow up. And now living back in Ketchikan, which is a different town, it's a lot bigger, but I just feel so happy and so thankful that I was able to grow up in a spot where things are so, you know, alive and real like that.
So did you fish mostly for halibut, or did you do some salmon fishing in the ocean too?
Did some salmon fishing in the ocean. We had a river that was bikeable from home, and so I was always the river kid. My brother liked the ocean fishing for the bigger fish, but I'd go down the river as soon as I could. I got my training wheels off my bike, and as soon as I could, my brother could take me out, and as soon as I could go alone, I was just always going to the river with my buddies and just fish, just salmon, just coming home with a salmon on each handlebar. You kind of had to catch two, because if you had one salmon, you know, you had 10 extra pounds swinging on a handlebar with, you know, that little huffy bike that you used to have when you were, you know, fourth or fifth grade or whatever it was. That would be off balance. So two, one per handlebar was perfect. If you could get four, two per handlebar, that was perfect. It was just, oh, it was so much fun. So much fun.
Man, that's really cool. Yeah. That's really cool. Cause I never really got independence in the outdoors until I could drive, until I was 16. Mm. My dad started letting me hunt alone. Cause I, you know, I moved out from Key West at an early age, and I always wanted a John boat and a little motor, but, you know, I was just too young. And then it comes time to, you know, start learning how to hunt. And, man, it's just too dangerous. I mean, well, I guess my dad thought it was too dangerous to have a, you know, 12-year-old kid in a deer stand alone, which I'm not arguing with him. But I mean, you could fall out. A lot of stuff could happen. But that's really cool. You experienced that independence from such an early age, and especially in the world of salmon fishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's amazing to be able to. And I didn't appreciate it till I left, but just the amount of money that people pay to go up there, you know, to live out the dream. Oof. And just where you're coming from and where you're going. And that's the thing about living in Alaska is, you know, a lot of people are making posts about, you know, 2 weeks until the trip of a lifetime to go blacktail deer hunting in Alaska, or people who've paid thousands of dollars to come up and fish. And it just makes it so much newer for me. And it refreshes and reinforces the fact that, man, I live in a really special place. Like, I'm the resident here. Like, I get to live here. And if I don't take advantage of that stuff, it's almost like I'm misusing it. It's like a slap in the face to everybody who saved so much money to make it a trip of a lifetime you know, who aren't TV personalities, you know, who saved up money for years to be able to go once and go up there and fish. And man, I just got to grow up on that river. You know, I got to just do all that stuff, and it's I'm so thankful for it. And it makes everything new and fresh, like I said, and I just want to keep doing it.
Yeah, I can understand that. My girlfriend and I just moved back out to Bozeman from Tennessee. I graduated college and I had to move home for a couple months, which was great to spend the time with the family. But man, it's so crowded here. It's hard to find a place to live. But anyways, we moved back out here and we just had a conversation about how cool it was and how lucky we were just to be able to drive 20 minutes and be hiking in the mountains. And I definitely feel what you're talking about on. It's kind of a disservice to all the people who have always dreamed of coming out here to just not take advantage of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost ludicrous.
Yeah.
Just to not be in the mountains and not hunt and fish and backpack and hike and climb and explore as much as you possibly can.
Yeah. I think we fall into the trap too, because we are so good. And I've mentioned this on so many of my podcasts that, and I have to remind myself that it's so easy to regurgitate the brochure and say, you know, living in Ketchikan is great because you can do this and you can do this and you can do this. Well, you can do a lot of stuff, but do you do any of that stuff? It's so easy for us to just, these answers, these right answers are so readily available to us. We can recite them at any point, but is that actually true? Do I actually go hunting and camping and fishing? Do I do that all the time, or do I just go a couple of times when the weather's nice?
Yeah, that's very true. And you know, I'm guilty of probably having too many hobbies. I was just telling Malin, my girlfriend, that I want to get a dirt bike so I can ride in the mountains, and she said, when are you gonna have time to do that? You're always fishing and hunting and hiking and everything. And you're exactly right. I mean, there are just so many cool things to do in both Montana and Alaska. You just don't have time and to do everything. And for me, the journey to mastery is really fascinating. And so I try to focus on fishing and hunting just to be able to master a craft. And what's interesting about that is you're never going to feel like you've truly mastered, you know, elk hunting, no matter how many elk you've killed. And you look at a guy like Cameron Haynes, who seemingly is probably the best elk hunter alive right now. And he says it, you know, every time he posts, I have no talent. I'm not a master at this. I just work my ass off. And, mm-hmm. you know, occasionally, maybe 4 or 5 times a year, I get lucky and kill a big bull.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those pursuits, man, that you're never happy with where you are. And there's always room for improvement, no matter who you are.
Yeah. I think that idea of you practice, like it's your practicing doctor, like you never reach the point where it's over, you've finished it. And what's the, is it a Chinese motto or something like that, that it's always, you practice martial arts. Like you're not an expert, like you mm-hmm. never achieve that supreme greatness. You're always a practitioner of it. And that sort of idea is so important too, because I think once you think you've gotten to the point where you can't improve anymore, then you just become some arrogant person. And it's, like with everything, you know, like podcasts, I listen to some of the podcasts and I think, man, here's how you can improve. It's not to bring self-doubt or to not feel, you know, worthy. It's just to know, hey, I can improve and I should improve. Let's make this better. Once you think that you've got it figured out, then you're undermining yourself.
Well, usually once I think I have something figured out, something happens and makes me feel like I don't know anything about elk or permit or trout or makes me feel like it's my first day on the water or in the mountains, and it happens every season, multiple times a season.
Yeah. I get frustrated sometimes, and I just, you know, when I was a kid, I was the kid who would like chuck my rod in the water, you know, but I've learned to kind of control the temper a little bit, and now I get frustrated, get down, but then I think, hey, come on now, just relax.
Yep.
It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. But, yeah, it's crazy. Is there anything that like you have reached a point where it's not monotonous, you're not over it yet, but is there something that, you've done so much that it might not have the same appeal that it did?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. There probably is. Probably shooting does, whitetail does. I am to the point where it's, you know, just kind of so-so for me to shoot a doe. But I found ways to make it so much more exciting, and that's taking new people. It's one of my favorite things in the world to take a new person to kill their first deer. I took my sister to do it this year, and it was just such a joy to be able to see her harvest her first deer. And I'm just kind of at the point where I look at a doe now, and you know, I don't get nervous like I used to. I'll do it for management purposes, but and then meat purposes. But it's just kind of so-so for me right now. And that's, you know, you just have different stages as a hunter and angler. And at first you're so hungry to learn because you don't know anything. And then you start to figure things out, and all you want to do is be in the river or in the woods. And then you kill your first buck, and then, or you catch your first 20-inch trout. And then you say, okay, well, I have to do that 10 times to really feel like, you know, I'm going somewhere. And you do that, and you move up to a different age class or whatever. And eventually, you know, you start to get to the point where all you really want to do is give back, and you get the most excited when somebody does that for the first time. Yeah. And that's kind of where I'm getting is I love seeing people do things for the first time. And I, you know, that's kind of what I'm after. I haven't killed an elk with a bow yet. I haven't killed a mule deer with a bow yet. I haven't killed an antelope yet. And I'm kind of more after those firsts right now. And I think that's just the maturity of a hunter.
Yeah. There's definitely something, you feel a whole new level of purpose and gratitude when you're able to help someone else out. And I feel kind of uncomfortable, like, considering myself a mentor, or, you know, because I just don't think that I'm, you know, qualified for that title. But when you are taking people out for the first time and you are helping them and showing them, that's by definition what you're doing. I think the best mentors are the people who don't call themselves mentors. And so I think that it's just such a fun opportunity. I'm so grateful for those opportunities to be able to help people out and to be there for someone else, because it's just an awesome opportunity to give back, and it's definitely, definitely fun.
Yeah. And, you know, hunting's kind of like a drug in some ways, where you're always chasing that first high, I guess you would say. That's, you know, that's definitely a bad way of explaining it, but that's really the only way I can explain this to somebody who hasn't, you know, yet experienced that. And I'm sure you have listeners who are non-hunters as well, but you kind of chase that yourself, and you remember how shaky you were and how nervous you were on your first year. And
what are you talking
how
about?
Excited
I was calm and cool. Like, it was no big deal.
Oh man. I had the worst buck fever when I shot. My first year was a four point white tail, and that's a Tennessee 4 point, not a Montana 4 point. So in Montana, yeah. we talk about 4 points as 4 points on one side.
Yeah.
But I still kind of prescribe to the Tennessee way of thinking, where, you know, 2 points on each side is a 4 point. But anyways, it was, I mean, it just seemed like the biggest deer in the world to me. And having my grandfather there was so awesome. And I just love sharing those experiences. And one of my favorite memories is getting one of my best friends, who's actually stationed in Hawaii right now, as a combat engineer, his first buck, and he killed a serious trophy of a first buck. But his eyes were so wide, and he was so happy and excited and just taking it all in. I mean, it's just really cool to be able to introduce someone to something that you love and care about so much, and see their reaction to it, and you know, hopefully contribute to another hunter in the woods.
Yeah. I saw a meme that was circulating the internet, and it was like this cave drawing on the wall, and it said, there are no cave drawings of catching salad or collecting salad or something like that. So that was pretty funny, because it was a cave drawing of a hunter, you know, shooting an arrow at something, and it just made a lot of sense. But it, you know, like, we're all descended from hunter gatherers, and, you know, the capable men were the ones who were hunters, and, you know, that's who we're descended from, you know. And for some of us, it's seems a lot more real. And I think a lot of people, if they had the opportunity, they would do it. But if everybody had the opportunity, then there'd be a lot more people in the woods. So,
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing about opportunity, because we're so lucky to have the opportunity. I mean, I'm so lucky to have the opportunity to be in Bozeman and to be raised in the, Florida Keys, and you're so lucky to have the opportunity to live in Alaska. And a lot of people don't have that opportunity. And if, being offered the option, they very well might choose to hunt. There's a something that I thought was going to come out with the pandemic is, more of where our meat comes from. And that was kind of surprising that it didn't. But that's a whole nother piece of hunting and fishing is, where does your meat come from? And I guess to sidetrack a little bit, that's really where Ranella and his team at Meat Eater have really shined and really shown what, why to hunt, what kind of feelings are evoked from harvesting your own meat, cooking your own meat, and seeing the process through from when an animal was alive to when it's cooked on your table.
Yeah, he's a great storyteller. His book American Buffalo is great, and so he has that journalistic storytelling. With each thing, there's something larger with each episode, which is really great, and it's a great show for sure.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, they do a great job. Go ahead.
I was going to transition a little bit here. What's kind of what do you feel that your role is? What do you work on? What's your goal in this space?
That's something that I've been trying to figure out for a while, Jeff. I'm really not sure where my role is. I love telling stories about people and experiences and animals and fish. And I guess I'm trying to infect others with the same passion that I have about the outdoors, or at least make them understand where I'm coming from and where my friends are coming from and people of a like mindset are coming from, and to get people excited about the outdoors. And maybe there's a person that listened to my show that's never been hiking in their life, and they've been sitting on their couch all their life, but they hear a story about a backpacking trip in the Wind River Range, and they got a trail right out in their backyard, and for the first time ever, they decide to go out in the woods, and that could change their life. And I just want to have a positive voice in the outdoor space, and that's really all I'm trying to do. I'm not claiming I'm anybody special or of anybody that has a huge expertise, because I'm still learning myself and taking in the knowledge of others and the resources that they have put out there. But I love sharing stories, and I love being a part of that positive influence in the outdoors, and it's very rewarding, and it feels worthwhile.
Yeah, I like that you started it without really knowing where you're going. I think a lot of people get so concerned with, well, I have to figure out my mission statement, and I have to figure that out first before I can start it. And it's like this long line of excuses that actually prevents them from actually starting. Yeah, absolutely.
Just do it.
Some of my first episodes with the podcast were just clunky and bad. And some of my first columns were like, oh my gosh, well, they still pay me for it. That's great. But man, I'm just getting better. And I think that's part of it too, is refining that as you go. And, being a practicing writer, being a practicing podcaster, being a practicing whatever, and know that you can get better, tell better stories, and always find different angles. But that is pretty sweet.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And just improvement. I'm a sucker for improvement. I love improvement. It's probably my favorite thing. Yeah. And the outdoors is some place that I've seen an incredible amount of improvement. I'm looking at my brother right now inside, and he came out to Montana, never really fishing and hunting all that much. And he came out here wanting for an adventure, and I've seen a tremendous amount of improvement, not only in his outdoor game, but in mine as well. And it's just something that I want to be a part of and continue to be a part of for the rest of my life. And it's, it's very tangible in the outdoor space, because you getting better, you know, I guess there is luck involved, but getting better, I guess, is consistently doing what you set out there for. And when that is put to fruition, it's just an overwhelmingly emotional experience.
Yeah.
And something that really makes me keep coming back for hopefully the rest of my life.
Yeah. It's addicting, like you said, like just to get better at things. You get to be an improved model. Like, you get to have more enjoyment. You get to be, just feel better, act better, be happier. Like, why would people not want that? It's weird that there's such such an industry for keeping people where they're at, you know, and people almost prey on that. Just stay where you are. You're great how you are. Like, well, improve the model, you know, like it's, you don't have to hate yourself, but improvement is great. That's where you get your self-confidence. Do difficult things. That's where you get self-confidence. You don't get self-confidence because you just wake up one morning and feel more confident, or because I don't know, like you do difficult things, you improve. That's how you get your confidence. And it's just kind of gross to see people trying to undermine other people and make themselves rich by, or popular by, telling people that, no, it's okay to just underachieve.
Yeah, there's always going to be people like that. And, you know, you just got to block them out, man. And, you know, I wholeheartedly believe that you're some of the five people that you spend the most time around. And nowadays that means something different than it did 30 years ago. And, you know, if you follow all these negative hunting accounts, and there are a lot of negative hunting and fishing accounts who basically undermine the accomplishments of others. And it's probably my biggest pet peeve and my biggest, I guess, statement of my podcast is, look, just because you catch a 20-inch trout with a spinning rod instead of a fly rod doesn't mean that that's any less of an accomplishment. It doesn't mean that it's any smaller of a fish, because you're seeing this weird thing in this outdoor space. And I don't know if it's because of COVID or because of, you know, egotistical people becoming involved, but, you know, you see a kid who kills their first deer, and it may be a spike buck. And although that's not the best management practice, I mean, it's their first deer. And in my book, you get a pass on your first deer. You can kill any deer you want because it's your first deer. Mm-hmm. And some people may comment, well, that's a spike, you shouldn't be doing that. How dare you kill a spike? That's not, you know, that's not a real buck, because you killed it with a muzzle loader. You need to kill it with a bow. Well, I mean, what kind of example is that putting out there for that kid in the outdoor space? That's not what the outdoor space is about. And there's some sort of weird superiority going on that I try to be the antithesis of superiority, because really I like to do everything. I like to spin fish, fly fish. I like to bow hunt. I like to rifle hunt. I mean, anything and everything. I mean, I like to, you know, run trot lines for catfish. I mean, I like to do anything and everything. And I think that learning each specialty increases your overall knowledge of the outdoor space and the animals and or fish that you're pursuing. And there's been an increase in that superiority, and it is not cool, man.
No.
I mean, it is pushing people away, making people feel bad about their accomplishments. You know, it's like the smart kid in class coming up with an A+ when you worked your fucking ass off to get a B-, and you're so proud of that B-, and then some smart kid, you know, sticks their A+ in their face and told you it was easy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, I have to be conscious of kind of the culture of in my classroom. And I've told kids for so long, you know, you're the average of the five people you hang out with the most. But now I have to consider that if people are spending more time on their phones talking or being influenced by non-people than they are with their actual friends, that's got to be part of the talk now. If you're spending 4 hours on TikTok, that means that you're being more influenced by that than you are at people. And so that's had to be incorporated in there. But so I know you got to go here. So you got a closing thought about that or anything else, and make sure you let people know where they can find you and listen to your stuff.
Yeah. I guess I have a closing thought along those same lines is, look, if you're an outdoorsman and you have a passion for being outdoors or fishing or hunting, even in, you know, not related to fishing or hunting. I just like to spread the message that you should always encourage people who are looking to get into that space and be the one who, you know, sticks their hand out on a river to, you know, see a person who is obviously their first time fishing. They don't know anything. Maybe give them a fly that works. Maybe encourage them a little bit. You know, just be that positive voice in the outdoor space, because like you said, you know, along those same lines of trophy hunting, there are people who want to take away our privilege. And the more voices we get out into the outdoor space, that's a vote in legislation. And like we've seen in British Columbia with grizzly bear hunting,
right.
Although that's not in the United States, but we've seen proposals for legislation in Oregon that would limit our use of hunting. And those are real threats.
Yeah.
And just support those in the outdoor industry and never discount the accomplishments of others, because that could be the best moment of their life and they could want to do that for the rest of their life. And when you discount that, I mean, not cool, man, not cool. So just be a voice of positivity. And I have my own podcast, the Turn and Rollin' Podcast. It's available on anywhere you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Podcast, all those good places. I have an Instagram account, Turn and Rollin' Podcast. But I really keep up with my personal one more if you kind of want to see what I'm up to on a day-to-day basis. That's Turner Rowland 1, TURNERROWLAND 1.
Cool, man. Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks for all that you're doing, and thanks for taking some time out of your day.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care, man.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.